to entertain and be entertained by his wife. The Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, everything with which a man plays is unlawful, except shooting with his bow, training his horse, and playing with his wife. Surely these pastimes are correct. And Aisha reported that she had a foot race with the Messenger of Allah while they were on a journey, and she beat him. However, when she later gained weight, she raced him, and he beat her, and said, this one is for the other. So it is important for the husband, also in his relationship, it's his duty, to be friendly and playful with his wife, to provide an atmosphere of entertainment within the home. Otherwise, people will seek fun or entertainment through means which are not acceptable Islamically. Now, the duties of a Muslim husband, you know, are much more than what I have mentioned. However, I just wanted to touch on these because these are ones which are usually not spoken about, especially those concerning guidance and education. The tendency is to speak more about the physical aspects in terms of providing economics, etc. However, we have to keep in mind that since a human being is primarily a spiritual being, and the purpose of this life is for us to develop the higher spiritual qualities, to become the kind of spiritual beings which Allah had designed us to be, it means then that the most important duty within a Muslim marriage is to provide guidance for the wife. And I'm going to stop here and entertain any questions that the sisters may have concerning the duties of a Muslim husband. And I'm sure you have many that you would like to ask about. Some papers have been distributed, so if these can be questions can be written on them and submitted, then inshallah we can try to answer whatever questions have been raised. The first question is, what are the husband's and wife's responsibilities to the parents of the wife who are non-Muslims and have difficulty in accepting their daughter as a Muslim? It is their duty to continue to try to deal with them in a kind and helpful manner, that they should use this as a means of conveying Islam to them in practice, because we should never give up on people until they're dead. Once they're dead, then of course our bond is broken. If the parents have died as non-Muslims, we're not allowed to pray for them. So whilst they're living, then we have the duty of trying to convey Islam to them. If they don't want to accept that the daughter has accepted Islam, of course this does make the situation a bit uncomfortable, but usually with the coming of children, you know, this starts to change their attitude somewhat. And if people continue to deal with them kindly, eventually, you know, it's quite possible that it will cause a change. You know, Allah says, you know, in the Quran, that if one, you know, repels evil with good, that is their evil reactions or their negative reactions, if this is repelled with good, then you will find that the one who was your worst of enemies would become one of your closest friends. And there are many examples, you know, that we have seen in America, in the West in general, you know, where parents, you know, have been opposed for long periods of time, and then eventually they became Muslims and became very strong supporters of the family. So we always, as Muslims, we try to keep the best outlook we think towards the best, we recognize this possibility, and so we would continue to strive to give good when they give negativity and evil or whatever, we give good back to them to the degree that we can. If it reaches a stage where it's starting now to affect one's Islam, you know, the daughter is finding that, you know, it becoming difficult for her to practice Islam because of those parents, then they may be obliged to cut those relationships, you know, to the degree that it is necessary to protect the Islam of the wife or of the children, you know. Question number two. What you are saying about a husband's duties is true. However, it only works that way if the husband is practicing his Islam. What advice do you give to the woman who is trying to practice her Islam and her husband doesn't? What advice would you give someone who knows a family that is falling apart? Okay, it's the second question. It's the same person writing. Okay, a woman in that type of a situation has to continue to strive to the degree that she is able to encourage her husband to practice. If she can be around other Muslim women who are practicing and whose husbands may then be encouraged or asked to bring this person into their circle to influence, because, you know, much of this has to do with the type of people that the person is involved with. A man who hangs around with non-practicing so-called Muslims then is likely to be a similar type of person. But when such a person is invited into circles of people who are practicing and he moves around with these people, after a period of time this starts to rub off on him and it starts to improve that individual. So I would suggest that, you know, such a sister would try to get her husband, you know, involved in the circles of the other practicing and, you know, good Muslims, so that some of that these qualities may start to rub off on the individual and you know, change his own approach. Of course, if the husband's attitudes are actually preventing the woman from practicing her Islam, she's being stopped from practicing her Islam, then such a relationship, it is better that she gets out of. You know, if she's able to get out of it, then it is better that she gets out of it. Actually, some of the scholars here, you know, have ruled that a woman who is married, Muslim woman who is married to a husband who doesn't make salah, you know, that this marriage becomes invalid. Because if he doesn't make salah, then he has left the bounds of Islam and is prohibited for a Muslim woman to be married to such an individual. Because this is even, you know, this is worse than even being married to a Christian. This is married to a total disbeliever. I mean, of course, this is based on the precept or principle that a person who stops praying or who does not pray is a disbeliever. Some scholars hold that such a person is not a disbeliever, you know, unless he actually openly expresses belief, disbelief. Like, I don't believe that prayer is necessary at all. And a person who's not praying, but he believes he should be praying, would not be considered to be a disbeliever in that full sense, which breaks the bonds of marriage. He's a disbeliever in practice, what we call kufr amali, as opposed to disbeliever in his heart, what we call kufr qalbi. Now, kufr qalbi, the one where the disbelief has actually entered in the heart, has gone beyond the practice, that is the one which breaks the bonds. You know, this is so. I would say that, you know, if the woman's husband has not reached that state of disbelief, where the disbelief is not, is actually in the heart, that if he does believe but is just not practicing, that she should continue to work with him and try to get other people to work with him. But if it's an individual who has actually disbelieved in his heart, I mean, this person is queer, he does not believe in God or whatever, you know, doesn't believe in Islam, then it is actually prohibited Islamically for her to remain married to such an individual. The second question, what advice would you give to someone who knows a family that is falling apart? They are Muslim and the children are suffering. what should our duties be? Well, our duty should be to try to keep the family together as long as the reasons why the breakup is taking place are reasons which are not valid reasons Islamically. You know, if it is a case, as we mentioned, where, you know, one or other has become a non-Muslim in fact, you know, in the heart, then that breakup is necessary. But where it's a question of misunderstandings, you know, which usually develop in relationships, etc., then we should try to arbitrate, we should try to, you know, intervene and to try to bring them back together. I mean, this is why we know in Islam the process of divorce is one wherein arbitrators should be brought in if possible. And this is the way the Muslim society would really function, that when people are married, you're marrying two families are coming together as opposed to just two individuals. The problem which arises is when a person, either people, two people from the West marry, where it ends up being two individuals, there's no longer two families. Or a person from a Muslim society marries a person from the West, where it is a family, but then you're dealing with one individual. This is where, you know, this type of support may not be so readily available, where the families should get involved, you know, brothers, relatives, uncles, etc., you know, should try to be involved in trying to stop such a breakdown from taking place. In such cases, especially, it becomes the duty of those who are friends of theirs to try to resolve, help them to resolve the problems, to take the sister aside and try to find out, try to get to what the root of the problem is, and, you know, her, that sister may who was found out may relate that to her husband, who may in turn speak back to the husband who is, you know, in this position of a family breakup, you know, and trying to encourage that person to see the realities of the problem, or to encourage the person to sit with some people who may, you know, listen to the issues and offer some kind of solutions for them. In terms of the children, of course, you know, it is our duty to try to bring the children and try to advise them and to help them as much as we can, because for children it's usually very difficult for them to comprehend, you know, what is going on with adults, especially in the case of family breakups. Next question. If a person is convinced that they are bothered or made ill by the evil eye, what is the correct method of treatment? Some say saffron ink used to write the Quran on a paper, then soak the paper and drink the water. Some say a sheikh blowing into water, or anyone for that matter, and saying Quran and then drinking the water. Another way is if you think you know where the eye is coming from, the evil eye that is, you take something from that person, such as after they have eaten dates, take the pit, soak it, coming from the evil eye that is, you take something from that person, such as after they have eaten dates, take the pit, soak it in water, and then drink it. Or after they've walked somewhere, sweep up some of the dust they have walked with, stir it in water, and let it settle, then drink it. I want to state I don't agree with these forms of treatment, but I don't know where to find out what is right and what is wrong. People who are using these methods are convinced totally in their cure. Now, the concept of writing the Quran or Quranic verses in ink from plant sources or whatever, something which is not harmful, then washing and drinking the water, this is something which has been practiced by early Muslims. It is not something which the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam practiced. So some scholars are not in favor of it. The recitation of Quran over water, This is something which was practiced by the companions of the Prophet ﷺ and approved by the Prophet ﷺ himself. So this method, you know, definitely is an acceptable method. The last one, which is of taking something from the person after they've eaten or collecting the dust that they walked on, this sounds the farthest out. I mean, this, I don't think this has any basis at all. Not from what I've never seen anything in Quran or Hadith which in any way supports this. This sounds to be really beyond the bounds of the norm. We have the quls, which the Prophet Muhammad, which were revealed to him for protection from the effects of evil. Evil, particularly in his case, it was in the form of magic. However, we know in that first of the quls where it says, وَمِنْ حَاسِدٍ إِذَا حَسَدٍ, it is there where you're seeking refuge in Allah from that form of jealousy or envy, you know, which is usually referred to in the end as the evil eye. So one, to me, may recite these as the Prophet Muhammad used to do before going to bed. He would recite the Qul, this Qul huwa Allahu Ahad, Qul a'udhu Rabbil Falaq, Qul a'udhu Rabbil Nas, into his hands, then blow in his hands, wipe it over his body. This is what he would do. One may use these surahs, reciting these surahs on different occasions, reciting them over water and drinking the water. These are acceptable methods of trying to cure oneself from the evil eye. But ultimately, one has to believe strongly that it is in the hands of Allah that one will be cured through these methods. Two methods which have been prescribed by the Prophet Muhammad himself, which he used himself or which he did himself, or which others did, his companion. So, I mean, one has to have that conviction that Allah can cure them from such harm, can protect them from such harm. And with that conviction, inshallah, one will be protected. But it doesn't mean that one will not be affected. Because if Prophet Muhammad was affected by magic, it means that no matter what you do ultimately, I mean, it's not possible for you to create an air of perfect perfection, of protection around yourself all the time. It means that you use the different methods which the Prophet taught, you know, of reciting Surah Al-Baqarah in your home, you know, of the last verse of Surah Al-Baqarah, you know, Ayatul Kursi, reciting this after different prayers. You know, different du'as which you gave before going into the bathroom, seeking refuge in Allah. You know, a variety of different occasions when you're coming to your home, you know, calling on Allah, using Allah's name. All these different things are practices which help to create a kind of a wall of protection around yourself. But it is not possible to create one which is perfect. It means at times that, you know, you may not, and so you may be affected. However, the reality is that these are means which Allah has provided to His Prophet Muhammad for us to protect ourselves, and we should avail ourselves of it. Now, not just in the time when we feel some problem, this is when we start to use it. But no, this should become a part of our daily norm before we're going into the bathroom, before we're coming into our homes, leaving our homes, putting on our clothes. The various du'as which the Prophet Muhammad gave, this should become a part of our daily life. You know, in that way, we can help ourselves, protect ourselves. The next question, there is a controversy concerning whether or not it is permissible for a woman to read the Quran during the time of her menses. What is the most widely held position of the ulama regarding this matter? Is reading while wearing gloves allowed? There is no prohibition from the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ for a woman from reading the Quran in the state of her menses, or for a man to read the Quran in any state. There is no prohibition. Prophet Muhammad ﷺ did not prohibit. All we have is the statement that the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ used to recite the Quran under all conditions except when he was in a state of janabah. that is after having sexual intercourse, when it was necessary for him to take a bath. This is the basis, this is the foundation under which, from which all of these different opinions are derived. So some scholars made a comparison between the state of janaba with that of menses. But of course they're not the same. Because the state of janaba you can remove by merely washing yourself. Taking a bath, your state is over. You can now read the Quran. I mean, whereas in the state of menses, a woman cannot just wash herself and go and read. She is still in that state of menses. So the issue of reading the Quran, it is most authentic that she is allowed to read the Quran. It is preferable in the case of janaba, particularly for the male, that they don't, since this was the normal practice of the Prophet. However, it is allowable. If a man, even in a state of janaba, felt a desire to read some verses of the Quran, this is allowable. We say it is not preferable. There is more reward in following the way of the Prophet Muhammad, even though it was not commanded. So the most authentic position really concerning recitation in a time of menses is that it is permissible, but perhaps not recommended. In terms of reading, because what we're talking about here is reading the Quran where one is touching the Quran with one's hands. Reciting the Quran, which I was really referring to, reciting the Quran in a state of, from one's memory, this is the area where I don't think there really is evidence to prohibit it at all. However, in the case of touching the Quran now, you come to the issue of touching the Quran when not being in a state of tahara. And we know that the general hadiths do indicate that this is not permissible. Some scholars have made allowances in case of for educational means. What you will find in some schools that the women may have a stick with a, you know, with rubber at the end or whatever, a little pointer which can turn the pages without her directly touching it, but she's still reading the Quran. So in that case, if a stick is allowed, in other words, that you're not directly touching the Quran, then it would appear that gloves would also be allowed to do this. But if we are dealing, assuming this person was asking the question, is a person of an English-speaking background, if we're dealing now with a translation of the Quran, translation of the meanings of the Quran, then all this is of no importance at all. Because translations of the Quran are not considered to be Quran. So no matter what state you're in, you can read it. You can pick it up, you can read it, you can touch it, it's no problem at all. Because the Quran that we have, even if there is the Arabic text there too, it is still not considered Quran. The general position which is held in determining what is considered Quran and what is not, is that whenever the words of other than Allah in a given text is more than the words of Allah, that text is no longer considered Quran. Because Quran refers to a single verse. If we take a verse of Quran by itself, this is called the Quran also. But if there comes along with this verse other words, you know, you've given an explanation of it, which is more than what constitutes the verse, then this is no longer considered Quran. This is why, this is deduced from the fact that the Prophet Muhammad sent messages to the kings of Byzantium and Persia, etc., which had verses of Quran in it. And he knew full well that these people are going to be in a state of janaba, they're kafirs, and they will probably tear it up, maybe step on it or whatever. So we know that this is permissible. Once the words of Allah are drowned out by the words of other than Allah, which is the case of the translations of the Quran. In such cases, these are not considered to be Quran, and as such, it's perfectly allowable for a woman to read it under any state, and a man also. The next question, where may I find a hadith which refuses or which does not, which prohibits the slapping on a woman's face of children and animals? Well, actually, in preparing the for this talk, I did not dig up the ones which have to do with animals. But the one which is the general one, you should not strike, you know, even an animal in the face. But the one concerning hitting a woman in the face, this can be found in Abu Dawood and Ibn Majah. In the book called Al-Hadith, volume 1, page 211 and 212, hadith number 63. It's reported by Muawiyah, or Hakim ibn Muawiyah. The other hadith, if the person really wants it, I have it at home, I just didn't get a chance to add it to my footnotes. If they really want, they can, you know, contact me through their husbands or whatever, and I can send the hadith for them afterwards, inshallah. The question is, the Yusuf Ali Quran a text or Quran? Of course, that's what I just explained already. This is not considered to be Quran in and of itself. It is a translation of the meanings of Quran. We call it like tafsir, a tafsir of the Quran in English. Well, there's a question. It says, in reference to the last question, yes, but what is the husband's responsibility to help the wife with her family? I guess this must have been in relationship to what are the husband's and wife's responsibilities, the wives or the parents. It is the duty of the husband to help his wife with her family. I mean, this is a part, these people have become a part of his family by marriage to her. I mean, it is not the direct family, but it's a part of his family now. So he has an obligation to try to convey Islam to them and to help her to convey Islam to them. He shouldn't just say, well, they're your family, that's your business and your problem. No. He should help her. If she needs materials, she needs tapes, or, you know, if she's going to visit them, if he's with her in the States, whatever, he's going to visit them, he's going to visit them, that, you know, he should go and try to help to convey Islam to them, because you know, as I said, where one's treatment of them in a good fashion may bring them around. If the husband is not there trying to show that good side and to treat them in a good fashion, then, you know, how can we expect them to come around? How can we expect them to see the superiority of Islam, you know, wherein, you know, people are treated in the best of manners, you know, even though they themselves may be acting in, you know, unacceptable fashion. Well, this is seems to be the last of the questions. So, inshallah, we will stop here now. Subhanakallah. Huh? Well, okay, I guess so. Some brothers are here would like to ask some questions. You're welcome also. Come here so it can be heard.
Recently, I ran across an incident where there was a brother who had more than one wife, and he was showing favoritism to one over and above the other one. And the question that was related to me was what to do in a situation like that. Should we insist we divorce the husband, or what? How does she handle a situation like that? Islamically, what's the best way to approach such a situation?
The sister who is being neglected?
Yes.
Well, I mean, what one would have to do in a situation, I mean, we know that it is the duty of the husband to treat both wives, you know, equally or equitably. And if he does not fulfill this, you know, the Prophet ﷺ had said that he would come on the day of judgment with one side of his body, you know, hanging. you know, that it is a crime and he would be punished for it on the day of judgment. However, in a marriage, because you don't even have to look at a plural marriage, in the case of a single marriage, if a husband is neglecting his wife, you know, he's married to only one person, but he's neglecting her, he's busy out doing many, many different things, what does she do? Well, it's the same, real, same question, really, ultimately. I mean, she should strive to inform him of the neglect and the need for, you know, giving her more time or whatever. And if he fails to respond, then she has to look at the relationship herself, you know, and make an assessment of the relationship. If she finds that the relationship is a burden for her, life has become unbearable.